welcome to the Raptor Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network, brought to you by Campbell's new chunky spicy soups. Time to get fired up. Make sure you find the Raptor Show wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe, please rate and review the program. I'm your host, Wim Liu. It's a glorious Friday in Toronto. Joined by producer, co-host, Amaman. How you doing, man?
Good, man. For one last time, Blake Murphy will be back in a couple days on Monday.
That's what I kept promising last week, and didn't happen. But I did hear from Blake. He is on the mend. He is feeling better.
Exactly.
His cat is feeling better as well.
Even better.
Yeah.
Even better.
They're just both, like, recouping right now.
Both on the mend.
Yeah. So, but they'll be, they actually would love to see his cat in the studio. Well, Blake will be back on Monday, as you mentioned. But
yeah. Blake Murphy. Hey.
We have not heard that drop in so long.
I've never heard that before.
Yeah. Well, it's because Blake didn't want to hear it all the time.
Well, I want more. Give me more.
That was all. That was all thanks to producer Derek, who used to always hit the Blake Murphy Tuesday drop back in seasons 1 and 2 of the
Raptor
Show.
I recall that. I recall that one.
Yeah, every
Blake
Tuesday.
Blake Murphy Tuesday.
Yeah. What else? Actually, because Blake's not here, I actually felt really bad about it because we have Jose Calderon come on the show.
Jose Calderon. Okay. That's how I say it.
I was not expecting that, Ahmed.
That's how I say it.
Yeah, Numero Ocho will be on the show. Obviously, a longtime Raptor. I think still second in Raptors franchise history and assists. Maybe we'll look that up. I don't know if Fred got past him, but I kind of doubt it. I think Kyle's definitely number one. And Jose previously was number one actually as well. But the reason I kind of felt bad about it was that's actually Blake Murphy's favorite player, is Jose Calderon. So the point where he actually named one of his former pets, he named a dog after Jose. Yeah. And he wrote about it extensively back at Raptors Republic.
So the dog's name was Jose or Calderon?
It was Jose.
Okay. Yeah. He is second all-time in assists.
Yeah. There you go. So Jose is coming on, and then we're going to talk to Michael Grange at 3:30, tee up tonight's matchup between the Raptors and the Magic. But on a much more sober note, if you haven't heard the news already, I wanted to pass along a statement. This comes from the Barrett family that was released last night, and it stated that it is with profound sadness and heavy hearts that we announce the loss of our beloved son and brother, Nathan Tyler Barrett, who passed away on Tuesday, March 12th, surrounded by his family, church, and friends. While our family is devastated by this great loss, we will continue to cherish the memories and time spent together. Nathan was a God-fearing young man of strong character. He was thoughtful, kind, loving, compassionate, creative, admirable, and driven. During this difficult time, our family would like to ask for privacy, but greatly appreciates the outpouring of love, support, and prayers that we have been receiving. Through this time, although his time with us was brief, he will live forever in our hearts. So that came from the Barrett family. I know RJ has been away for the team the last couple of days due to a personal reason. It is so sad and so unfortunate that this has happened. Nathan, I believe, was only 19. And his younger brother had passed. And I think the Raptors, obviously in this case, will do everything they can to support RJ and his family, however much time he needs to process something like this. I'm sure he will take, and I'm sure the Raptors will give him that space. And I think that, you know, or at least I really hope and I really trust that there will be some sort of way for the Raptors to tribute and honor his family when RJ does return to the lineup eventually. But that's obviously very secondary to this really sad news. So,
yeah. I mean, as a parent myself of two kids, this is something that I don't think they'll ever get over, right? This is something that's going to linger. It's going to hurt for a very long time. You don't get over it. You just learn to cope and move on as best you can with your life. So I wish them all the best. This is extremely, extremely painful. It's an awful experience to go through, and I wish them nothing but the best, them and the family, RJ, everyone. Very, very sad.
Absolutely. And, you know, for Rowan, too, who obviously manages the Team Canada program, you see Rowan all the time at Raptors games. You see them all the time after the game. You know, everyone clears out. The arena is pretty much empty except for people kind of just picking up and tending to the arena, maybe sometimes changing over to the hockey side. And you always see, like, friends and family sticking around. You always saw Rowan and his family and the Barrett family just sticking around after games and stuff like that, too. So, just want to send our best wishes to them in this difficult time. And there's no real way to pivot and transition off of this. So I'm just going to say that we will talk about the Raptors and talk to Jose and other things as well. But just wanted to pass that news along. And it's, again, really, really unfortunate. So the topic I wanted to talk about with the Raptors was just sort of checking up on how this sort of transition to the rebuild was going. I think that, you know, we have learned a couple of things this season because of all the trades. And even though we're not being able to finish out the season by seeing everybody healthy and available to play for a variety of reasons, the Raptors have had, honestly, a lot of really unfortunate setbacks.
Yeah.
Right. We haven't been able to see the whole group, operating in tandem. Having said that, though, we have seen this team transition and pivoted off to this sort of Barrett, Barnes, and Quickley core.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that we have seen them play together now for about 2 months without Pascal Siakam since that trade to the Pacers. So I want to ask you, what is something new you've learned about each of BBQ since the Pascal trade? Let's start with Scotty for you.
Scotty Barnes, once again, like, maybe it's not new because he's a, when we were talking about doing the segment, we were kind of looking at like what kind of teams or what can they emulate in terms of a rebuild model from other teams. And I kept on getting stuck because I'm like, he is so unique. Mm-hmm. There is no player type that really fits what Scotty is. And that's what makes him so great. So again, it was nice seeing him be that guy that he was for a few seasons with the Toronto Raptors when they had Fred and Pascal and everyone, that he can just find his spots to continue to put up points. Now, how they integrate him and get the best out of all three of them, I think is kind of the tougher one because, you know, ideally a person of his size, you want him to be like your dribble handoff big, but they're going to have Jakob Poeltl. They have Kelly Olynyk who can, you know, Kelly can space the floor, but I mean, what is Scotty's role within that? He can obviously, handle the ball. He can run pick and roll by himself. He can be a ball handler in DHOs too. But how do you get the best out of him along with getting the best out of the other two players? Because he's probably the most versatile of the three, but getting that chemistry in between all three of them and getting them in sync is going to be the harder part of Darko's job here. So I didn't really give you much of an answer, but he continues to do stuff that makes him valuable despite maybe not having as much of an on-ball role. And it's impressive. It's very impressive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we've seen Scotty play, well, it's technically 20 games, but I'm going to slash out the Warriors game because he got injured midway through and just got to bring everything down. So he played 19 complete games, we'll say that much, since the Pascal Siakam trade. Scotty averaged 19.7 points, 7.7 rebounds, 7.2 assists, 1.1 steals, 1.6 blocks, shot 46% from the field, only 22% from three and 84% from the foul line. I think number one for me is like in the first two seasons of Scotty in Toronto, obviously it was a very different team. But you saw that his numbers actually did improve both in volume and both in efficiency when he had guys like Fred and Pascal on the floor with them. And I think that, you know, there were obviously ways that those two, especially as the older players, but also drew a lot more of the attention to, at least in the first two seasons, were able to make things a little bit easier for Scotty. And, you know, when he was on the floor without some of the main creators, that's when you actually saw like a dip this year. Especially in these 20 games, even without those guys, obviously they've since been gone. Fred moved on to free agency. Pascal got traded. You saw that Scotty was able to maintain his level and continue to go forward. I think the only thing is just the three-point shooting came down, which, you know, at the start of the season was really hot. In the middle of the season,
he cooled
off.
Shots got harder, that's for sure.
Shots got harder. I think scouting reports got a little bit harder as well. But ultimately, the general production of his game was still pretty strong. And, of course, there were still some ups and downs for sure. I think that it's a bit head-scratching what happened at the end of that OKC game in the overtime periods where he didn't really want to be involved or even in that Spurs game. But ultimately, you've also seen a strong rebound from that. And I really liked his focus and intensity post-All-Star break. And I really felt like he was taking ownership and leadership over the team in a way that made me feel very confident. So I'm hoping that that just continues after he's able to return, whether that's this season or next season.
Yeah.
What about Quickley? Quickley played 18 games now without or since the Pascal trade. He has averaged 19.2 points, 4.7 rebounds, 6.9 assists, 0.9 steals, shooting 43% from the field, 39% from three, getting to the foul line only 3.3 times per game, which is a little bit low, but it's trending upwards recently, and he's launching about 8 threes a game.
Good.
What is something new that you've learned about Quickley, especially now that he's been able to run the team, even without Scotty and RJ available?
Yeah, it's pick and roll. We talked about it a little bit yesterday too, is that this is going to be kind of the key. Like if you look at all three of them, they're going to be advantageous for the Raptors in different ways. Like RJ, they can all ball handle, which is awesome. But, you know, coming off pin downs and getting in the paint, that's going to be kind of RJ's thing. He's very good at it. And IQ, he needs his kind of realm of, you know, possibilities of how he's going to be executing on the offensive end. And I think pick and roll, getting cerebral in that kind of sense, and getting chemistry with Scotty, with Kelly, with Jakob. We've seen him kind of get that going with Kelly over this last little while, but obviously the other two players aren't here right now. But him being comfortable, kind of like going into a storm where there's a lot of bodies, sometimes he's getting blitz, sometimes there's a strong hedge, sometimes there's a soft switch, whatever the case is, and he's recognizing that and he's making plays out of it. That's growth. That's maturity. That's him taking strides and also probably watching film, talking to Darko, all that stuff. And that's going to be where he's going to get the bulk of his points probably outside of, you know, just like chasing down threes and that kind of stuff and catch and shoots. But him getting that area of his game down now, also the rest of the season and going forward, is going to be where he's going to be so effective for this team. And it's just like a different element that they really require to be a good offensive team. Like a couple of things that come to mind with these three is that in the last 15 games, right, their net rating is 6.2, right? And that's in 291 minutes.
Are you talking about those three on the floor?
Yeah.
Together. The net rating is 6.2, which is pretty good considering the fact that the Raptors have lost, obviously, a lot of these games. Yeah. So the fact that when they have their main three, they're actually a positive is a really strong point.
Yeah. And like a big positive, right? Like some of the best lineups, if you're looking at three-man combinations, like the Denvers, the Clippers, things like that, they're around like 9 or so, 9, 8. And so they're not that far off. Obviously, small sample size, but they're trending in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's
for sure.
Really important for them.
For sure. And this is the only sample we have to go off of, right?
Yep.
Because until Pascal got moved off the team, like he was still the number one focus in scouting reports and things like that. And you take this new direction, this new group, see how they played. RJ played 14 games since Pascal was dealt, averaging 20.6 points, 5.4 rebounds, 4.5 assists, shooting 55% from the field, 47% from three, which is amazing.
Holy,
55% from the free throws, which is a little strange. But, yeah, I mean.
Maybe Jose can help him.
Honestly, maybe.
Some
but
pointers.
I think for RJ, for me, it's just he's been really, really engaged. It's not really a game I ever watch him, especially as a Raptor, where he's not giving his absolute very best and trying to find a way to win.
Yeah.
There are things you can sort of look at in the margins, like getting better defensively, getting more consistent off the ball, catching, shooting. You know, maybe even just creating his own shot, things like that. But, like, generally speaking, he's taking the right shots. He's been really efficient when he's been asked to run the offense. And, yeah, I mean, I think he's not been a pleasant surprise, but I think he's shown you a lot of that promise and potential of what he was coming out of college. And it's not like his time in New York was just purely bad. It wasn't.
Yeah.
But New York fans were kind of hot and cold a little bit on it. And I think for Raptor fans, we've only gotten reason to feel hot about the fact that he's been – you know, red hot from the field.
Yeah, red hot, definitely. He was labeled a toxic contract coming to Toronto, which is insane considering where he is now. He's shooting 45% from three over the past 15 games. And
by the way, the context around that, I just really wanted to put that out there to be clear. It was Zach Lowe who mentioned it after that trade happened. And it wasn't Zach Lowe's opinion. It was him talking to league executives who had described it like that.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like RJ, by the way, it was strange because RJ's not on like an absurdly large contract.
It's pretty reasonable considering where the cap's going to be going.
Yeah, so RJ Barrett is on roughly about 30 a year going forward. Yeah, it's at 24 this year, 26 next year, 28 the year after, and then 30. So even less than
escalates.
That.
Yeah.
So, like, that puts you in the ballpark of, I don't know, it's less than, like, Jeremy Grant, for example.
Sure.
Or it's, like, less than Tyler Hero.
Yeah.
It's less than Jordan Poole.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's totally fine by me.
Yeah.
Like with him, I mean, he comes into this system and he's exactly what a Darko Rakovic would want from a player on the wing, right? Being able to come off pin downs, go hard to the basket, being able to make decisions on the fly, kick out passes, skip passes. There's some turnovers issues, sure, sometimes, but I think that's part of the system too, is you're making fast decisions.
Mm.
Turnovers are going to be along with that.
I mean, look, if you give me 20 points and shoot 55% from the field, I'm okay with you having 2.5 turnovers.
Exactly. It's absolutely fine, especially because finding his guys, right? He's finding them in the corners. He's making nice passes. He's making quick reads on the fly. And I think that's what is going to be his role going forward. Like he has to be the person that is just suffocating and so hard to guard through pin downs. And like there were cases in that Denver game where they were trying to shade him right, but he kept on getting to his left, which is, you know, Darko had said the Manu Ginobili comparison. Now, he's not there exactly, but Manu was always very good at that. Like, you can try to make him go right, but he'll find ways to get to his left hand, to get to where he wants to go on the court. And it's been, like, the instincts, the ability to just make fast reads on the fly in traffic. Mm-hmm. It's been pretty good for the Raptors. And defensively, we'll have to see like where they want to go with his role on that side of things. We'll get to it in a second, I guess. But, you know, is he going to be an on-ball suffocator, an on-ball stopper? Is he going to be reliable on like back cuts and stuff like that? Because he has had some issues with that with the Raptors, along with a lot of the players. They're going to have to figure that out. But overall, I mean, he's been a huge positive, and it's a bright future to me for RJ.
Yeah. On the subject of defense, so we had this discussion yesterday.
Yeah.
Because we know that these three will have Jakob Poeltl joining them in the starting group. So it's really just a question mark as to who the fifth starter will be. And the Raptors have been really struggling defensively. I mean, I put the stats out there already, but since December 1st, the Raptors are 29th in defensive rating. Mm. And that's through various iterations. Like, OG was still a member of the team in December. Right. And then Pascal still remember the team in January. And then, you know, we've had injuries obviously since. It's not like since the injuries they're like this. Like, no, they've just been consistently like second worst in the league for the majority of the season. But in any case, who is that fifth starter that should be playing with this group? And I have some questions for you otherwise, but just like, what's the general type of player that should be the fifth, you know what I mean, starter?
Yeah, this has been like a topic for us kind of over the past few weeks. And it's a hard thing to figure out because you have Scotty, you have RJ, decent three-point shooters. Like, you don't really know where they're going to head out, right? Like, I mentioned the numbers with RJ, but I'm not sure if that's going to be, you know, the case going forward. Scotty was having some issues in the latter part of the season. But you have IQ, right? He's a high-volume, good three-point shooter. If you have Scotty and RJ just constantly putting pressure on the rim, you kind of do need, like, a knockdown shooter. And I'm talking about Gary Trent Jr., that five-some of them has been pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And but at the same time, now they're also using Gary as their screen navigator, their perimeter guard, who has to get through screens and fight through some pretty aggressive play by, you know, some pretty notable point guards. And also, you know, it's making like he's kind of like the first line of defense. And if mm-hmm. that breaks down, like your whole defense breaks down. And he's had some ups and downs with that. He's trying. I see that there's a commitment there. But is that the answer for you? Now, if it's not, then okay, so IQ's doing that. Now he's used to that. But now everyone else kind of gets shifted in a different area. And Scotty and RJ, they're going to be your wing stoppers. But then you need that extra person. And it probably has to be someone with a bit more size, right?
Probably.
And I think that would be probably their best route. And how are you going to acquire that player? I don't think they have that person in-house.
That's the interesting thing. Because when you're talking about roles, like, they typically, and Darko has typically not put quickly on the tough opposing point guard.
He hasn't yet.
So what you're, and then what we saw Scotty settle into was those big tough wings. He will take those,
mm-hmm.
but then those tougher guard, point guard assignments, Gary was taking those. So it depends. You want a guy with size, but the bigger you put him, and then all of a sudden it's more difficult for them to like navigate screens. So it does become a question of, do you want another guard who can really get around screens and also play some good defense and knock down some shots? Like a 3-and-D guard, or do you want more of like a 6-9 type of forward, like you know, who can really cover just in general and play a lot of help defense? To me, I think it's probably a little bit more important to get a guard just so to stop those opposing guard matchups. And that's where it's going to be interesting. The Raptors do have a number of in-house contributors. I think two candidates for this. And my question for them is just, can they be positive contributors next season? And I had Grady Dick and Ochai Agbaji on this list.
Yeah.
So I think we reasonably have confidence in Grady, especially seeing the second half of the season. But I think it's a question of how positive. Like, is this so positive?
In terms of your confidence.
Can he start for you?
Can he start? So he's going to be this person that we're talking about, the next person.
Oh,
man, I don't like putting him in that position to be that player. I don't think he's there yet. Like, he's been having some issues, like, over the past few games. Like, after that Portland game, teams are guarding him differently, right? Mm-hmm. They're getting he's getting a lot more pressure. His decision-making has to be that much faster, and he's being challenged. And now you want him to do that along with being, you know, relied upon to play some solid defense against, you know, first units, not second units.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really sure. But also you want to have a decent bench unit too. And his scoring, his ability to shoot the ball, his chemistry he can form with like a Kelly Olynyk, whatever the case is, he could be a lineup raiser, mm-hmm. right, for that bench unit. And I like that idea. And you can decide, you know, going down the stretch of a game, if he's hot, if he's feeling it, if you're having some shooting issues and he's your guy right now, then roll with it. But putting him in that position, I don't know. And then we got Ochai, and I kind of said my piece about him yesterday, and after reflecting on it, I thought maybe I was a bit hard on him. I felt that maybe, because like he's playing lineups right now that aren't going to be lineups going forward, right? Like if he's playing with better players, if he has Jakob Poeltl and Kelly Olynyk as the bigs and he's cutting off of them and he's going out with the players that are going to make clear cuts and they're going to roll properly, they're going to cut at the right time, then it's going to complement him too. Yes, like he's going to be a 3-and-D, take your shots, finish in transition, that kind of player. And defensively, is he ready to be that stopper that we're talking about? That's what I'm not really sure about. I would do wonder that, you know, if he gets into a offseason program with Darko and they settle in on something that they want him to truly get better at, like that's an opportunity for him to kind of take this role because they need it, right?
Yeah,
and that is an expensive role to try and fill if they're trying to win games next season and they need this, right? There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, I think Ochai, best case scenario, I think he can maybe slide into that as a fifth slot. He can guard guards, which is really nice.
Yeah.
He can be that point of attack defender for you. But offensively, there's a clear gap between him and Grady, and there's a clear gap between a guy like Gary. And he, Gary's on this list of, are they still here next season?
Yeah.
Right? So Gary Trent Jr., unrestricted free agent. Bruce Brown, team option, right? And also there's obviously a lot of discussion about potentially moving him on. Jordan Wara, unrestricted free agent. Jonte Porter, you know, you have his rights, so you can choose to control.
Mm-hmm.
And then I put on Javon just for you, man. I know it's your guy. I'm just going to assume he's already here. But those first three, Gary, Bruce, and Jordan, which of them are still here for how much and why?
I wouldn't be surprised if none of them are here.
Okay.
Starting with Bruce, look, they need a backup point guard. Mm-hmm. They need someone. He's been in that role. And from the signs that I've seen, and I'm sure you've seen, it seems like he wants more of an on-ball role. He wants to get his shots up. That's what I've been seeing. Right now, this isn't the same role that he had with the Denver Nuggets, and I think that he wants to deviate to something else where it allows him to get his game off a little bit. And I don't know if he is the person. If you're going to have a backup point guard doing that, I don't know if he's the guy for that. Now, if he's going to be settling into a different kind of role, then maybe it makes sense. But also, as you know, Bobby has mentioned too, that's a pretty interesting contract. You can do a lot with something like that, and I'm sure there's going to be a market for him. So that's something they got to consider, and I personally,
do you think his play with the Raptors has changed the market for him?
I don't think so.
Really?
Because he's already shown that what he can do on a championship team.
But he did that with Jokic.
Yeah.
And we all know that Jokic he raises the tide of all players.
I think more so is about the defensive end. And he was on that back line of like when the pick and rolls happening with the sorted teams, like he was the guy that was making like strong rotations, him and KCP. He was very good at it. He was the guy that was checking.
I'm not saying he doesn't bring value, but I think for a lot of teams when they're acquiring former Denver players, how many players have left Denver and people are like, ooh, they're even better, or ooh, they're exactly the same as what we got before. And how many of them are like Will Barton?
Yeah. I mean, he's a little younger too.
And
there's that. And I think there's still the elements of his game that are intriguing. Like there's some shooting. Obviously, there's the cutting game. And if
the cutting,
he's able
I think,
to,
is the best thing he can do. Like and, almost function as a small big man.
But he's got to finish his layups, man. It's like that,
that's going to happen. That's going to happen. It's actually interesting because, you know, I feel like when you said it was like, all right, he wants to get his game off. I'm like, you know, it does feel that way when I watch. But then when you look at his usage, it's at 15.7 with the Raptors. It's actually a little bit lower than Indiana, where he's 16.7. And then last year with Denver, he was at 17.8. But 15.7 is actually directly in line with his career average. But I do get that sense where he's taking these gambles and he's making these sort of aggressive pushes. And I think that that's ultimately where it's sort of coming up a little bit short for him. But to me, it's just a question of, can the Raptors get what they want out of this situation, right? Can they get a first-round pick? Can they get a prospect? And if they can do that and they can get Bruce into a more competitive situation, I think it's a kind of a win-win
for
everybody.
What would you want for Bruce in return?
Like,
what's the ideal? Because I've wrestled with the idea of maybe you're able to find some sort of 3-and-D kind of player.
I think I'd take a pick. But would you take an Ochai Agbaji-level prospect for him?
I would, yeah.
Yeah, I think I would too.
Yeah, maybe a little taller, but yeah.
So is Gary here next season, you think?
It's hard. Like they have a lot of cap space, and but they have to consider that
they got
to re-sign IQ soon. They got to re-sign Scotty soon. So you got to
extend Scotty.
Yeah, but the money is going to get much more expensive.
But it won't kick in for next year.
True. But if you're going to sign him to like a long-term deal, right? That's something they got to consider their future money.
Do you feel like Gary's a guy that maybe you put inside the money? Like, is Gary a guy that you want to put like a 2-3 year contract under, or like a maybe 3 or 4 year contract? I think that to me.
Yeah.
It's kind of like,
see, he's trying to prove that he is a starting caliber shooting guard. And
that
the
will
reason
require
why,
him to really guard and continue to you know, be efficient with his offense. He's done good with his offense. He's, as the year's gone on, he's getting better and better in offense and finding the level that we know him to be. But defensively, or the second skill, has always been the missing part.
Yeah, and he's got to find out what he's capable of, I think. Like, it's either he's going to be your sixth man kind of thing, or he's going to be this person that Darko is letting him audition to be.
Right.
And has he shown enough to warrant, you know, the extension that he probably does want with the Toronto Raptors? I don't know about that, but there's still time, too. He's questionable tonight. He might come back, and maybe we can see a better, more of a sample size of what he's going to be bringing to the table.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's still TBD. I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
I'm not saying no. I'm just saying that we still have to figure out where Gary's going to be at the end of the season.
I feel like, hasn't he been roughly the same player for the last 3 years with the Raptors?
He has been offensively, yes. Yes, he has.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think this role that he's being put in, it's on purpose because they want to see if he can do it. And that's where they want him to be. They could make the decision that IQ is going to be this person. Yeah. They could do that, but they're not. Why are they doing that? Because they're letting him, like, show me. It's a show me moment.
If he's willing to do 2 more years at similar rate to what he's currently making, for me, I'm happy to keep Gary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, and I mean, he's a great locker room person. It seems like he's a good dude. Everyone that I've encountered, probably you've talked to him a lot of times too, mm-hmm. that they like him. And he's a good locker room person, which is obviously very important, team chemistry. I saw the other day that they were letting one of the team equipment managers, I believe, they were bringing her up to dunk. I saw it on the Raptors IG page. And he was like featured in that. He's always smiling. The fits are awesome. This is all chemistry. It all contributes to it. And I wouldn't be mad if they re-sign him, but it's just like the stuff that we're talking about defensively is where I'm kind of, is this the move you want to go, you know?
Well, look, if you can find an upgrade, by all means, go ahead. But otherwise, I see no reason that we need to necessarily move on. I know some people are just not a fan of his style. That's fine.
Yeah.
People have preferences, and you know, you can adjust based on it. But again, I would like to see the Raptors not just lose players for nothing.
Sure.
I think the last question I had was just, how are you feeling about Darko in general? I think because you see the offensive execution with him, it's been very consistent of what he wanted to do when he came to Toronto, right? Mm-hmm. Moved the ball a lot. Fourth in passes per game, the Raptors are this season.
Yeah.
That's up from last year. They're third in assists per game, which is definitely up from last year.
Mm-hmm.
The Raptors, as Darko described to start the year, they have a lot of their bigs handling the ball and directing traffic. You've seen that with all three of their centers, right? You've seen that with Jakob, with Kelly, who they brought in, and then Jonte, who they brought in. All three of those guys do that to a large degree. You see a lot of cuts. You see a very few isolations. I know, remember one thing where we were interviewing Chris Boucher at the start of the season, and he said Darko had this drill for them in training camp where you weren't allowed to dribble.
Hmm.
Whole time, all you can do is cut and move and pass. And that was to sort of to teach them to sort of like get them out of some of the bad habits, but also get them to understand how much easier the game can be if you do it like that.
Very European.
Very, very. But, you know,
I like it.
The Raptors have followed through. They're third last in terms of isolations per game. They rarely isolate. And in terms of cuts, they score the seventh most in the NBA off of cuts as well. So I think you're seeing Darko's offensive plan in action. My question now is, what is his defensive plan?
Question. When you were looking up that seventh in cuts, did you also see what they were in points per possession? Because I think they're like kind of in the middle 20th area, which is like if you're going to be cutting this much, you probably want more points out of it, which is something that they also have to address. But yeah, defensively.
I mean, how do you address having more points off cuts, though?
Huh? Finishing at the rim.
Well, okay. All right. I mean,
essentially, like,
I guess
finishing better at the rim. Yeah, that's kind of it. But I mean, they all go hand in hand together. Having better offensive flow, having like, you know, better.
They're fine. They're like 1.33 points per possession on cuts.
Okay.
I think it's just really just a question of like how many cuts can you get in a game?
Sure.
Right. Because that's a very efficient play technically. But in any case, I do agree with you though. They can finish a little bit stronger, but it's like right in line with league average. And they're typically finishing with guards rather than like, I don't know. Like, I feel like the Nuggets should be number one. Like, it's Aaron Gordon just catching lobs,
man,
from Jokic. But yeah, defensively, what is the? I get Darko's offensive vision. I largely agree with it. I like it. I think we can even say it's aesthetically better than what it was last year. I think that's undeniable 100%. Too. What is the defensive vision?
Side note: well done getting that quote from Garrett Temple yesterday on how the Raptors have adjusted their defense.
Yeah.
Before they were funneling, now they're weaking, stronging, which is essentially you're forcing guys towards the baseline on their off or strong hand because they don't have the rim protector anymore, right? Jakob isn't there, so very different. But anyways, Good job on that.
Thank you. I mean, it was Garrett's. It was Garrett's, this is something Garrett chose to reveal, not me. I was thinking about just how can they improve defensively, and I'm still thinking about that question.
So with that, I mean, I think we got to see them healthy, definitely. I think concepts-wise, he has shown some ability to make adjustments on the fly. Now, something else we have to consider, too, is do you have the personnel to make those adjustments on the fly? That's something you got to think about, too. Side note again, I was listening to J.J. Redick's podcast, and he said the only time in his entire career he's ever been blitzed off a DHO was in 2019 against the Toronto Raptors. And he said that their rotations on the back line were insane. That was like an incredible defensive team, but you can do stuff like that when you have the personnel for it. But if you don't have the guys that are in sync with the game plan and can make these like live reads that are very hard to do, it's hard to make these adjustments on the fly that maybe he's thinking he wants to do, but he's like, yeah, but then maybe like, you know, this guy's not going to be here. It's going to be open layup. And now like, where are we going to, what are we doing? So that is something that we have to consider. Personnel wise, I think they have the guys to be a strong defensive team. I mean, they have the rim protector. I've thought about, you know, without Jakob Poeltl, like how does this defense look going forward? Because I mean, I'm just like going through a bunch of possibilities with this team and they still need that guy. And it's no different than where we were a couple years ago when they got Jakob Poeltl, that they need a rim protector. Every team needs someone. You want some versatility with your defense and how you're able to guard teams. But at the same time, you need that guy. So Jakob Poeltl is there. I think once they're able to get back to funneling towards him, that's a very good thing for this defense. And then you have RJ, you have Scotty Barnes. I think that's very good.
But my question there is, again, we've had Jakob for most of the season, and the Raptors, again, since December 1st. December 1st, they are 29th in defense. So that alone is not changing it.
I hear you. I want to give him some grace because that's when kind of the three different versions of this team started. And I think that's been, that's heavily influenced the productivity of their defense. That's my opinion on it. I think, I don't want to like you give him a scapegoat, but we've seen them raise their level at different times defensively. We've seen it against the Denver Nuggets. We saw it against Portland at times. Getting it, them to do it, you know, possession by possession.
Realistically, everybody has possession stretches or even quarters, halves, where they play good defense. But consistency is the consistency. And I think that's where, to me, it's like, what is showing, what is it with the Raptors where it's like, if you don't do this for me defensively, you're not going to get minutes? You know what I mean? Like, where is that line?
Well, I mean, I haven't seen that line all season. And that is a problem that I have. I was going to get to that, too.
Go ahead.
It's the accountability aspect, I think, is really important. Now, I don't think players are being held accountable right now and by design because so many injuries. This isn't the version of the team we're going to see next season.
I'm not asking for this specific team who's probably going to play Jamyus Ramsey tonight.
You can hold players accountable easier when you have better players coming off your bench, right? Like, you can say, like if RJ is, he's missed a few rotations, and he's done that before with Gary Trent Jr. I've seen it. He's done it with RJ, but that's when they were healthy, right? They bring in another guy. He has a conversation. Gary even cited that he's done that already with him. It was in the second half of a game when Gary was healthy, obviously. But anyways, he took him out for like 3-4 possessions and he went back in. So he wants to do this, but you just have to have the people for it.
I hear you.
It's a cop-out answer and I apologize, I can't judge him defensively right now based off what I see at this very second. Like they're going against like the Orlando Magic tonight, and
but
how many players do they have?
I'm not asking to judge off this game, Amon. I'm asking for the whole season, because even at the start of the year, right? When we saw the starting lineup. OG, one of the best defenders in the league, yes or no?
Yeah.
Jakob Poeltl, you mentioned how important it is as a rim protector. He's a really good defender, right?
Yep.
Pascal, at least average, if not above average.
Better be for the Pacers, but
Okay, whatever. Pascal might be the weakest of the five. Scotty, is he a really good help defender?
Yes.
And then Dennis, is he a pretty good on-ball defender?
He should be, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
With that starting five for the most of the season before OG got traded, the Raptors are still dead average in defense.
Yeah.
15th.
It's true.
That to me is like, and listen, that group might just not work together defensively because, you know, for example, last year with the Raptors under a different coach than Nick Nurse, they also didn't guard at a high level either. But I also thought there were other issues alongside of that, and they only got Jakob for the last third of the season. When they did get Jakob in, their defense was actually pretty good. My point is, though, even when they had better personnel, I didn't see that defensive execution and like intensity or consistency. And that's, to me, is like, unless we get to that point, we're going to have a similar season again.
When did it kind of fall off the rails? I was just doing some quick number crunching here. So from October, beginning of the season to, you know, mid-November, right? They were in the 7 range.
They were good. They were good at the very, like,
3 weeks
of the season. They were good.
So refresh my memory if you can. Like, what was there an injury that happened?
No, I mean, the starting five was actually really healthy. I mean, even OG missed some time.
Yeah.
Because he cut his hand moving some furniture or whatever. But still, like, ultimately, he was, the starting five was actually remarkably available.
Mm.
And then up until the OG trade, like, they had their starting group together for the most part. And, that doesn't even account for, like, having better defenders off the bench, for example, like Precious.
And this might get down to, like, we're problem-solving on the fly here. I think this might go back to the adjustments part, where maybe that we're not seeing him be as innovative. And, like, you and I have talked about this, too, is, like, you know, in certain cases, like, are you making the proper lineup changes at that moment where you just have to do it? Otherwise, you know, a team goes on, like, a 12-0 run. And, like, in a game of runs that he's also echoed before, if you take 3-4 possessions off and you're not making the right decision, like, a team's going to kill you there.
Right.
And I think that's a sound point that maybe on that side of things, he has to probably get a little bit better. But also I think that he probably did get a little bit better over the course of the season, because I think we're seeing more of that now, but now he doesn't have the people to do it.
Well, the other flip side of this is I think maybe he took this year to really put in the offense.
Sure.
And next year he puts in that's more reliable. Everyone understands that a little bit more. And then especially with a healthier group, put in defensive. Because again, Raptors aren't going anywhere if they're 29th. In defense for 4 months of the season again.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
That's my only thing.
Yeah.
So I would like to see an improved amount of defense from the group and also from the head coaching staff. But
in
any case, you could also put in the greatest schemes. And if your team's not executing or if they're not giving the right effort or, you know, whatever, you know, but
and also,
it's
when
a big
you're
question
a team,
for me, though.
When you're a team that is building through your wings, which they kind of are in a way with RJ and Scotty, I guess we're going to have to see like what they do with their starting lineup going forward. They have to be your best defenders, right? Because they're going to be relied upon to be your wing stoppers, your help defenders in a lot of cases. So it kind of starts there with this team.
Okay.
And it's going to be on Scotty and RJ to level up there. Not that they can't, but that's how I kind of look at it with them, with a team like the Celtics too. Mm-hmm. It's no different.
Mm. All right. Well, that's where we're at in this point in the season. We're going to take a quick break and then we'll come back and we're going to talk couple topics around the NBA. So we're going to take that break. I've been your host, Willow. You've been listening to The Raptor Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network, brought to you by Campbell's new Chunky Spicy Soup.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Raptor Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, William Liu. Continue with joined by producer co-host Amit Mann. Amit, taking us around the NBA. What do you got, man?
All right. So just to start off right here. So first off, congratulations to Shai. He passed Kevin Durant in Thunder history for most 30-point games in a single season. Mm. Right. So now he has 48. The record was 47. So awesome. Like that's him. He gets 30 points a game on the rec. However, the game that he did it was against the Pacers, and I'm going to bring up the play right here because it's been a little bit scrutinized, and it's the concept of stat padding. Now, regardless of this game, he was going to break the record, obviously, because he's been doing 30-point games nonstop throughout the year. But in this play, it's a 10-point game. Obviously, the Pacers are about to win it. There's 14 seconds left. He fouls a Pacer to make them go to the free throw line, and then afterwards, he runs the ball down the court, open lane because no one's really playing defense. He gets a layup, 2 points, and now he's past the record. And after that, there was some ridicule from people on the internet saying that Shai was stat padding. Now, to me, looking at, I actually want to hear your opinion. You saw the play. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on it? What are your thoughts on the idea of stat padding? And also, based off the play, did he have to do that?
Did he have to do it? Probably not. I mean, they were down 10 with 15 seconds to the left, and he fouled Andrew Nembhard, and, you know, his fellow Canadian went to the foul line, knocked down both to make it a 12-point game. Then he raced up the floor for a layup. It's a complete non-issue for me.
Yeah.
I think stat padding first off, it doesn't really hurt anything. I think at the most, it actually is quite funny to watch. Like, this, to me, is not even that funny. It's just like, whatever. I mean, there's lots of plays in the game where it's out of reach and guys foul and they try to extend the game. You know, who knows? Maybe even his coach was saying to do that. But, and But I think the funniest thing is, like, when you get those, like, Ricky Davis trying to chase his own triple-doubles, that's when he's like, okay. Or, like, JaVale had a couple of those back in the day where he, like, threw it off the glass to himself and tried to get some more rebounds. Andre Blatch had one like that. So
Giannis did it last season, and the rebound was taken away, so he couldn't get the triple-double.
Yeah, Arizona. But, I mean, like,
yeah,
I don't know. It doesn't matter to me. Yeah.
No?
Yeah.
What bothers
it's
me
It's nothing
about,
to be shamed for, though, for sure. It's not a shame thing to be shamed for.
There's no reason to view Shea differently, because even with the play, like, maybe he did do that, but I thought it was notable that after he made the layup, he continued to play defense. So is it a case of a player just playing right till the very end, right? The game's over, but that's like kind of the MO of some teams. Anyways, just want to get your thoughts on that one. What does bother me about something that we're talking about is when a player refuses to take a shot at the end of a quarter because they want to save their field goal percentage. That's stuff that does happen. There have been several players that talked about it. That bothers me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that actually, I totally agree with you. Like, if you're just protecting your numbers in that kind of way, then no, I mean, you should do everything you can to try to win the game.
Yeah.
But it is, by the way, I mean, are we just glossing over the fact that Shea has now more 30-point games in a single season than Kevin Durant ever did? That's nuts. KD won MVP and led the league in scoring at 32 points per game in 2014.
That's amazing, man.
He played 81 games that year. And you're telling me that Shea has more 30-point games than him in that year? That's
And still more games to go.
A lot more games to go. Yeah, he's already at 49.
Yeah.
He's had 30-point games, and he's had 5 40-point games.
Do you believe in them in the playoffs? Do you believe they can win a few rounds?
I believe OKC is living a charmed existence right now. If and when they actually hit adversity, it's going to turn from everything is gravy to we got to focus on what are our weak areas. And when you re-pivot off at that point, that's when you start to truly win.
Do you think it's at the center position? Is that the weakness that they're going to get exposed through some of the bigs in the
West? I think
the
size in general is probably going to be their weakness. Also, I just don't think that Josh Giddey is going to be a positive contributor for them.
Yeah, he's not going to be playing the second half. We're not starting second halves, I don't think. We've already seen that a few times. Isaiah Joe checks in instead in some of the games that they're trying to win, that they want to win, and against some of the heavyweights in the West and East, and that's how it's kind of
I'm very curious to see how they do with this iteration of the group in making their first, like, full playoff run as a group together.
Yeah. We've talked about the rise in scoring. Everyone has. And, I mean, to me, like, correct me if I'm wrong, is it not as simple as if they just change the 3-second defensive rule, right? So how many seconds you can be in the paint? How many seconds? Like, they changed the rule in the back in the day because teams were taking advantage of it. But now with how open the court is, with how many players that can shoot the three, you got centers, you got power forwards, everyone, right? That's why we're 11-5 out. Is that not the remedy for what they're dealing with right now? Is just letting players be in the paint a little bit longer? And not even just like a big, like your Rudy Gobert's, but also just like having more players with 1 foot in the paint for 2-3 seconds longer.
So what do you want to change it to?
4 or 5 seconds?
I think that's fine. I actually think that will certainly help the defense. It probably will lead to even more jump shooting. And I know for a lot of people's concerns, it's like, I feel like a lot of games are just shooting a lot of threes and they're not comfortable with that. And by the way, that is the main change in league scoring. It's like, and I had the numbers up for Garrett when we interviewed him yesterday. And when Garrett first came into the league in 2009, the league average for scoring is 100 points and they took about 18 threes per game on average team.
Yeah.
Now, well, he's still in the league, but it's 2024. League average for scoring is 115 points per game, and teams shoot an average of 35 threes a game. I think if you add even more defensive 3 seconds, or even like make a defensive 5 seconds, or you take defensive 3 seconds out the game entirely and play FIBA rules, what you're probably going to see is even more jump shooting. So it's just a matter of preference, but I'm in favor of other rules that will change that will help the defense. But I'm not hard against like defensive 5 seconds.
Tom Harbistraw, he did an article yesterday, and he published essentially that the whistle just isn't going off as much for referees. So they're calling less shooting fouls, less non-shooting fouls, less technicals, less defensive 3 seconds, less travels. Everything's down. And that might be the way in which we're kind of seeing the trend go a little bit the other way, where we're getting more defensive matchups. I'm thinking about that Knicks 76ers game that was like 80, 85 or something like that.
It was in the 70s.
Holy smokes.
It was 79-73, I believe, was the final score of that game.
Detroit Pistons, what, 2002, 2003, whatever that team was. We went back to those days.
Yeah.
Crazy time.
Basically, yeah.
That was fun. I want to see more of that kind of stuff. So another one I want to ask you about.
Oh, you really like seeing 70-point games?
I want to see a change of pace. I want to see games where, like, yes, 120, 130.
That's a change of sport when you go from 115 points per game to 75.
That used to be the game that we loved, right? Some of these, like, remember some of the championships?
Finals? Hold on, Amit. That's exactly why the league changed the way to move to some of these rules to favor offense. Because people were not loving watching Pistons versus Spurs in the finals. And the games were in the 70s.
Yes.
Yeah.
So
I don't know if it's consistency. What we loved. It was like, we did love it and we needed to change. Now they overcorrected and now it's like, okay, we better cut back a little bit. But I don't think we want to see back the 70s scores.
In a random October, November, December game, if you're seeing the top two defenses go toe-to-toe, would it not be kind of intriguing seeing them go toe-to-toe in the capacity that we're talking about and just be amazing?
So what I like, and you know, game 7 between the Raptors and the Sixers.
Oh,
that
baby.
Year, right, 2019. Yeah. Of course. That's exactly the reaction everyone should have.
Holy.
Do you remember the final score of that game?
Nope, but I know they went like a 5-minute stretch where no one scored.
It was like 92-90.
Yeah, that's what it was, yeah.
That was a really elite defense in the Sixers, going up against a really elite defense in the Raptors. Now, of course, at that time, it's also the playoffs, and it's literally game 7. So it's going to be more intense than your average game that's being played on, you know, February 15th. Beware of the Ides of March. But like,
or a play-in game, the NBA hopes.
Sure, but... Nevertheless, that's what it should look like when two defensive teams play each other. So I'm cool with that. But 70s, it just becomes a brick fest at that point.
Yeah, yeah. There are a few more questions here, but I want to get to these trivia ones.
Okay, cool.
So trivia question number one, right? There have been a lot of 40-point games in the NBA, right? Okay. Can you name the 10 players that have recorded 40-plus points 5 or more times?
This season?
This season, yes. This season.
Shea.
Shea, yep. He has... I have it here. He has 5. Yep.
Embiid.
Yep. He has 9.
Which is amazing because he's not played for a month now.
Yep.
You said how many players? 5? How many players have done this?
There's 10 players.
There's 10 players who have done this.
5 or more 40-point games. Yeah. Oh, it's goodness. Crazy.
That's a long list. Okay. Giannis.
Yep.
Who else is leading the league in scoring? Has Jokic done this? Probably not, honestly. Yeah. He's not that high. Luka.
Luka, yes. He has the most at 12.
I don't know. Brunson. Has Brunson done it?
Yeah. 5.
Yeah. So what am I at now?
You have 5 more.
5 more players.
To help out?
Yeah,
go ahead. Think guards. Think point guards.
Think point guards.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know. Fox? Has Fox done this?
Yeah. 7.
Fox has 7 of these.
7.
Yeah, he didn't make the All-Star game.
Right? I know. It's tough.
Has Dame done it?
Dame, no.
Not
he's
yet.
Not in this category. No, he's not. Okay. Hasn't done it 5 times or more.
Hit me the rest of the list because I also want to talk about Raptors Magic.
Okay. Yeah. Steph Curry, Devin Booker,
Kevin Durant,
Donovan Mitchell.
Yeah.
Steph Curry has 6. The other guys all have 5.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's a lot of 40-point games.
Yeah. I was going to ask.
By a lot of players.
Yes, sir. I was going to ask you if you could name every person who's received a flopping fine, but I don't think we have time for that. Just to see.
I know
see
Gary Trent Jr. got one. And I know Kelly Olynyk, by the way, got one.
Yes.
Retroactively against the Nuggets. In which case, I'm like, he flopped against Jokic. What do you want Kelly Olynyk to do against Jokic? All right, NBA, like, please, that you got to have
flopping versus embellishment. The new epidemic.
Yeah. Okay, well, listen, tonight's game.
Yep.
Time now for Between the Lines, brought to you by Bet Rivers. Take a chance. Line tonight, Magic, favorite by 8.5. Over-under set at 217. So, again, you're seeing less scoring. But also, the Magic are just not that potent of a scoring team. Gary Trent's questionable. Obviously, no RJ, no Chris Boucher, no Scottie, no Jakob. But it seems like the Magic are pretty healthy. Amit, I think the Raptors have really struggled with size, so I think I'm going to go with the Magic. But what are you going with?
It's going to be the Magic. It's definitely going to be the Magic. However, if the Raptors do win this game, something to look at is Jalen Suggs versus Emmanuel Quickley. That matchup is going to be the key to the Raptors being able to score the ball and how they're able to get Jalen Suggs off of Quickley. That's going to be the key for them. But the Magic, they're a good team. They're a very good team.
I think for Quickley in particular, we've seen him go up against certain physical point guards that have really, really curtailed some of his effectiveness. Yeah. So it's a really good test for him. Hopefully the Raptors put up a fight, but we've seen some lopsided games recently. So that was Between the Lines, brought to you by Bet Rivers. Take a chance on the Orlando Magic. That's what we're saying. But anyway, we're going to take a break. I've been your host, Willow. You've been listening to The Raptor Show on the Sportside Radio Network, brought to you by Campbell's new Chunky Spicy Soup. When we come back, Jose Calderon, Numero Ocho, back in Toronto.
Everything you need to know about the Blue Jays, Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Raptors Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, Wayne Liu. Joining us, as promised before the break, a former fan favorite, probably a forever fan favorite, Jose Calderon, former Raptors point guard, second all-time in Raptors assists. If you're you don't have to be a longtime Raptor fan. Everyone knows who Jose is. Numero ocho. What's going on, Jose?
Hey, how are you guys?
We are doing really well. We're doing really well. Thank you for taking the time to join us. We wanted to talk about your time with the Raptors, kind of go back a little bit and just go through your career. We wanted to talk, obviously, with you about Spanish basketball as well. And then just a couple of assorted questions that have really come up recently. But, if you're good with that, I would like to start with your time in Toronto. And of course, you came here almost 20 years ago now. But do you remember how big of a culture shock was it when you first came to the NBA?
It was a little bit. It was a little bit. The biggest issue for me was, more than anything, was my language. I think it was I was playing a few times. I talk about the story about, you know, calling plays and people don't understand. And so it was a little bit hard. You know, we have to switch from voice calls to just signs because people felt more comfortable with the signs. Uh-huh. So it was a struggle. It was a struggle. That first year was tough. We got a great, great teammates. It's true that they helped me a lot. Mm-hmm. But being a point guard, coming from Europe, and not really speaking a lot of English, that was probably the biggest shock of all. I think Toronto is probably the more American city, but still more European than anything else. So for me, that helps, and it was a great adjustment right away.
Yeah. Did you have any funny moments in terms of, like, a language barrier? Or I know you spoke English, just not maybe as strongly as you do now. But did you have any funny moments of misunderstanding with players about just, again, that language gap?
There's two things. One, at the beginning when they were laughing in the locker room, I wasn't sure if they were laughing about me or of me. Or so they laugh, I laugh. So, but I have no idea. So maybe that's why they were like, oh, this guy is cool, because he's just laughing. And I didn't really know what was going on in the locker room. And after the second one was when one play that it was called Diagonal. Uh-huh. And I couldn't, it was Diagonal, Diagonal, whatever. I look back from half court, I'm trying to call the play, and my four teammates are looking at each other like, what's the play? Like, what are we supposed to be doing now?
Yeah.
So since that day, Sam Mitchell just changed everything. We went to a fist up, two down, horns up, and that's it. That was the end of that play until my English got a little bit better.
Yeah, things that are a little bit easier, signal with hands. I get it. So I think for a lot of fans, people are remembering about your point guard partnerships. I feel like every single year when you were with the Raptors also brought other point guards to help run the point with you, but also sometimes to try to compete with you. And I know that, obviously you stuck it out for a long time. Again, you're second in Raptors assists. I think that speaks for itself, the longevity. But talk to me about playing with TJ Ford and starting a point guard, the two of you guys sort of trading off on that job.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, for me, it was always good. All these, my teammates, I always got great relationship with all of them, because at the end of the day, it was about the team for me. So with TJ, same thing. He came, he was the starting point guard my second year. So for me, it was great. It was just keep learning from guys who've been in the league, around the league, and a great player who was able to score in a lot of ways. I was completely the opposite. So I think it was a good tandem for that team. And that was kind of like the thing. He got injured, so I replaced him for the starting position. And after from that, is when the Raptors in the third year, they decide to get me as a starting point guard. But for me, it was always that challenge of being together, trying to play the best I could. And I think usually the players that they were coming in to play my position were
just a different style of players. So it was perfect. I think he always talk about, okay, this is great for the team. He can score more. I can pass better or whatever. So that was, for me, always the key. And TJ was that. I still maintain a relationship with him.
Oh, that's nice.
It was a great tandem. We went to the playoff. It was a great season. And, you know, just the bad luck of him getting that injured that, you know, slowed him down a little bit, because for us was a really important piece on that team.
Yeah, I'm still mad at Al Horford. Every time I see him, I pack my mind. I'm like, but you hurt TJ Ford. And I know it wasn't on purpose, but I still get a little upset about it. I remember, reading a story. This is, again, so long ago, but I think TJ, you actually went to the coaching staff and you said TJ should start. And you actually volunteered to come off the bench. Can you tell me about that story?
Yeah, I mean, TJ came back from the injury. The team was playing really good, so the coaches decided to stay that way and bring in TJ from the bench. But, you know, it was two things. Like, he wasn't comfortable on that, you know, with his role. Everybody was kind of like waiting for him to be back at himself, and I thought it was the best way of, like, look, I know I've been playing good. I know the team is playing great, but... But we need TJ. We need more people to be able to get to what we wanted to be. And we were fighting to get that Atlantic Division title and everything like that. So for me, was like I always say, for me, always the team was first. So this is not about number or stats. So I thought that was a good thing for our team and for TJ as well. Just, you know, that's his role. That's he was the starting pointer. I was just replacing him. And I was just getting back to our regular spots, if
we
could say that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think first off, you know, a lot of players would want to continue to start, especially if the team's successful. But I think that's what you're talking about. You've always put the team first. And, you know, again, the team did try a couple different other point guards, especially after TJ got hurt. Jared Jack was brought in, Jared Bayless. I think, you know, some of these other names, but it didn't really quite work out. It was usually the coach would always come back to you. And it wasn't until Kyle Lowry came through where it was like, okay, finally, I think the Raptors can maybe pivot in a different direction. And unfortunately, obviously, that led to you getting moved off the team. But I was actually – we had Dwayne Casey on the show earlier this week, and Dwayne was telling us the story about Kyle, especially the way he was when he was earlier on in his career, was so, so competitive. And in his words, Kyle was trying to kick your ass in practice every single day when he was coming off the bench against you. What can you tell us about competing against Kyle, even within the same team?
It was great. I mean, I love Kyle. He's been a great friend since those days. I think the good thing I brought to the table is, like, they understood that you could compete against me as many times as you want, like, because it's good for the team. And that doesn't mean you cannot be friends and or be even best friends outside of those lines. So that was always me. That's the way I am as a person. So the competitive, like, it was great. I mean, I was learning. I was growing. He was making me a better player. I was trying to make him a better player. He listened. He understood that every time I was saying something, it was to help, not to trying to get anything wrong about it.
Yeah.
So that was the trust that was there. And, you know, a lot of things happened, you know, at that time. I was as well, my expiring contract. I was playing really well at that time. So, you know, it was Rudy Gay. They were able to get Rudy Gay on that trade.
Yeah.
So it was more than just, you know, giving Kyle the keys. It was just the situation of everything. And I think that was a good thing for the team, a good thing for everybody. I think Kyle deserved to be where he, you know, the starting pointer for that team. I think, you know, he was a different player when he arrived than when he when I left. And I mean, look what happened after that. So it was great. Great to see that growth of Kyle in Toronto.
Yeah, I think, are you and Kyle friends? Like, I feel like, I think I saw something where you wanted a reporter to tell Kyle to answer your text or something like that. This is maybe back in 2019.
Yeah, it was in the last, I think it was the last All-Star or something. I don't know what it was. No, the finals. I think it was when we played the finals. That was last year, no? No. Yeah, with Miami.
Yeah, I think it was in Miami.
So, I'm like, look, just ask this. And he spent some time in Spain as well. We always in contact. I'm in contact with DeMar, with a lot of the guys. So, like I say, it was always a good relationship. Even like from the outside, people maybe were thinking something else or trying to figure something out for us was, you know, about the team. I was trying to help them. I'm so, you know, happy with them and the career that they have after those years with me. So I love it. It was always great.
Speaking of DeMar, what do you remember about a young DeMar when he first came in? Because he came in super young, right? 19, and you're with him for the first, I think, 3 or 4 years. What do you remember about young DeMar DeRozan?
Well, I remember that he actually was probably the opposite of what he is right now. You know, like, he was a raw talent that couldn't really shoot the ball, super athletic. He is still being athletic, but he doesn't use it that much. But now he came to he went to the other way, like, so finesse, playing great. I mean, that footwork, he can not miss a shot every time he shoots from two. And he had his own style, you know. He didn't get into the what happened with the three-point line or the new NBA. He keep playing his way. He's up there in the scoring history of the NBA, and he still have a few years to go. So yeah. I think it was that same thing. A guy who was able to work, to listen, to really get better and wanted to be better and wanted to be the best he could be. I mean, impressive career what he's having, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. You could definitely tell how much hard work he put into that, right? Because I remember young DeMar, just like, obviously you played with him, but it was like exactly what you're mentioning. It was very raw, but to see him now and how skilled he is, the footwork, the touch that he has on his shot is incredible. But I think also something that takes a lot of hard work is leading the league in free throws. And 2009, you were at 98.1%. on the season, 151 for 154. I'm sure you get asked about this probably more than almost anybody gets asked about free throw shooting. But in that year, and I know your longest streak, I believe, was 87 consecutive, which I think is the second longest streak ever in NBA history. You made 87 for 87 at one point. Was that in the back of your mind? Did you ever, like, when you ever step to the free throw line for, like, a technical or you got fouled or whatever, did you ever get, like, is that in the back of your mind? Like, I can't miss this. Not just because I need the points, but, like, I have, like, an NBA record going.
It was there, but it was because it was getting bigger and bigger of a story, and that was the problem too, in a sense, because players start talking about it. Players were joking around, "Hey, I got $100 that you're gonna miss. I got a hundred that will get to 100 before you miss." So people start talking about it. Some teams too. I remember going into Sacramento, go to the line, and actually the guys from the arena just telling everybody, like, "Look, this guy got 54 or 55 in a row. Let's make him miss." So people went crazy about when I was going to the line in some places. So that was the whole thing about it. So I remember my three misses. It was an impressive year that I, you know, never get even close to that, because thinking now about it is like, it's almost impossible. Like, I didn't, I wasn't a huge free throw shooter, like, a number wise. So it was even more difficult because some nights I went only with one, and after maybe three one day or four or whatever, and zero for two games. So, so it was difficult to keep it that way. But, you know, it was a thing that it was there. I was trying to focus on the whole thing, and just it was. I remember the last game. Mm-hmm. I remember coaches telling me, like, "Don't go to the line tonight. Just shoot from the outside." It was a game that didn't mean anything to us before. I think it was, I don't know. But the coaches are like, "No, you have an amazing day." And I went, actually. It was 4-for-4 or something.
Oh, wow. Nice.
But they were like, "Don't get it. It's the last game of the season. Don't mess it up now after all these games making free throws." So I remember some of those stories.
For sure. I think it's still the NBA record for highest percentage in for free throws in a season. 98.1 is just crazy to look at when you go to your basketball reference page. I wanted to ask about your time with the Spanish national team as well. I know one thing, you know, Canada is doing a lot better recently, and actually Canada made the Olympics finally. The men's side finally made the Olympics by beating Spain in the World Cup last summer. So I'm sorry about that, but I know that the coaches, both the men's and the women's team, have spoken so much about how much they want to emulate the system that you guys were able to bring in Spain in terms of the connectivity from the youth level to the national team, and just maintaining that identity throughout, and being able to sort of put players into these systems that they can really thrive and be comfortable in their role. You know, when you hear that kind of respect given to the national program that you guys had with Spain, how does that make you guys feel? And how special was it to play under just some really glorious generations with Spanish basketball?
I mean, it's great, and I think that's the kind of like the pride or being proud of what we did more than anything, not more than winning or getting medals or go to the Olympics. I think for a long time we were able to be competitive and play for every medal, every trophy, and that was something important. The second thing about what you say about the Spanish and the coaches as well, that now in Canada, it's about for us going to play for Spain. It wasn't like I'm missing my summer. This is vacation for me. It was actually something that we love and we embrace as something great. Instead of going work out in summer, doesn't matter, Miami, LA, or whatever, we were working out with the best. I was working out every summer with Pau Gasol, with Marc Gasol, with Navarro, with Rudy Fernandez, with all those guys. Like, it's like, why instead of being by myself, I cannot be here having fun? So we were like a family. We love each other. Our families came to visit, and it felt like going with our families. We just, our family was the one joining the group. So that's kind of like chemistry that we have. It gets us to win a lot of championships that other teams didn't have, that chemistry, that good feeling with each other. And we never had the feeling of, wow, this is another summer that you're going to lose. Just, I cannot be, you know, on the beach or whatever.
Yeah.
We actually, you know, love to hang out with each other. And that was key for sure.
I think, you know, that's the chemistry that you guys saw, you know, on the court as well. I think that directly translated. You guys had such a great style, and I think it was such a distinct advantage because, you know, you look at some of the most historic games, and you think back to 2008 in Beijing, right? You guys played the gold medal match against Team USA. First off, what do you remember about playing in that match? Because it got really close. It was really intense. Like, do you ever think back on it? Because it might be a little bit painful, but I think you guys had a real chance to even take gold on that.
No, not at all. I mean, not painful. I think we lost against an amazing team in 08. I think it was a little bit more painful 2012 because we actually thought we could beat them after we lost the first time. So I think the second silver medal 4 years later, that was actually most painful than the first one. The first one, we were so happy to be able to get to the final. It was our first time going into that. It was our first Olympic medal. That's impressive. Some, you know, always something that you always dream as a kid, to have an Olympic medal. Doesn't matter which color.
Of course.
So we were, you know, we were upset because we lost, but we were so happy with the whole performance of the team and being able to get that. Now, 2012 was a different story, another close game. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at the end of the day, when you look at it really from perspective, they have an amazing team. It's impossible to stop all of those guys. Yeah. There's always, you stop, you know, LeBron, and it was D-Wade, or it was Chris Bosh, or it was Kobe Bryant, or it was Carmelo Anthony. And like, you cannot, you know, all of them having a bad day, it was tough. And we almost got it. So that was the positive thing about it, that we always talk. For us, maybe it was the one thing that we missed, having an Olympic, gold Olympic medal. Mm-hmm. We end up with three medals. Yeah. That is amazing, but we always lost against the U.S. And that's the only little thing. We were able to get the World Cup. That's no problem. We got it. Mm-hmm. But those Olympics, you know, they always, those, let's say the first teams, if you could say that, from the U.S., it's ours. Mm-hmm. Always tough to beat. And but they were scared. You could see the redeemed team. They could say whatever they want to say. Mm-hmm. But it was closer than when they were saying there.
Oh, for sure. Because I think, when I think back, and I remember watching it so closely, because I'm Chinese, and it was the Olympics in Beijing. It was such a big, big deal, absolutely. And, you know, I think back to the USA team, and they looked unbeatable. I think when they played other teams, it was like they were beating them by 30. But, yeah, it was close in the fourth quarters, and you guys had a lot of great moments against them. And, you know, it was really Kobe. I think, I don't know about you, but for me, watching the games, it was like Kobe really took over for that group. And and a team full of stars, it was actually him that took over. Was that your experience as well?
Yeah, as well. But I could see, you know, looking at the bench, at the other bench, their faces, their reactions. I knew them. I knew them from the NBA.
Yeah.
I know how they were playing and reacting with other teams. So we felt that they were like, okay, guys, this is real. This is getting close. And these guys are probably, you know, better than we were expecting. Or even if we were expecting that'd be good, they're actually playing good as well.
Yeah.
So that was the whole experience. But it was great. I mean, great challenges. We try everything. They came back with those big threes and all that stuff. So that was good. I mean, an amazing experience for us. Having three Olympic medals is something, you know, you cannot have like a dream even about it. So even if it wasn't the most precious one, but I think it was good enough.
I wanted to ask about two of your teammates on those teams. Number one, with Marc Gasol. So obviously you won the championship with the Raptors. Very beloved player here in Toronto. Actually, Toronto's had a lot of good Spanish players as well. Shout out to Jorge Garbajosa as well. Also a really good Raptor until he got injured. With Mark going into retirement, you know, what is he going to do next? I saw the big Instagram post that he made. So has that been announced, what Mark is going to do next? And do you still keep in touch with Mark?
Yes, we talk a lot, all of us. Mark actually owns a team in Girona. He's the president there. So he got a lot of like little things and other businesses, but that's his main job, being the president. He was the president, owner, and player at some point. the last year that he played, but he just decided to just stay on the front office and not be on the court anymore. So that's the kind of the official retirement thing. But we all knew that last year was his last playing, and that this year it was going to be difficult to see him back on the court. So he's doing great. Amazing career as well. We talk a lot. We all that generation are really good friends. We're so close that that is like, you know, it's just tough not to to enjoy now the what everybody's doing after basketball.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask about Ricky Rubio as well. He's opened up about his struggles recently as well. I just wanted to know if you've checked up on Ricky. How is he doing? And I understand he's gone back to Europe.
Yes, I mean, I've been in touch a lot because, I'm part of the front office in Cleveland, so he was part of our team as well, and a friend. So I was really close with the whole scene. And, you know, the best part about all of this, like, he's really happy. He's back on the court. He's playing with Barcelona. He played a couple of games with the national team in this the FIBA window. So he's back. I mean, he's smiling again. That's what we wanted to see. And me as a friend, you know, like, so that's the main part. So taking him playing last night, it was great as well. I was watching a little bit of a EuroLeague game. And so nice. So it happened to all of us. You know, you got to be always taking care of not just your body, but your mind as well. And I think that's special. And he came out in one moment that maybe not a lot of people were able to do, like right before going to a main event with Spain and be the main guy. And he decided to, look, I need some time and go home. And he, I think he for sure will help a lot of people in a lot of different sectors of the life, because I think this is not just professional sport. It's any people in any kind of work. I think it's important to being able to take care of their mind as well.
Yeah, it was very brave for Ricky to put himself out there like that and explain himself. And I know it's not easy. I think in sports, all we focus so much on delivering results and how are you going to be on the court and what are you doing to win the next game. But I think when you take a step back and you see moments like that, that was a real courageous thing that Ricky did. I'm curious, especially from your side with the Cavs, like what are some of the ways that Cleveland and you guys in the front office and as an organization did to support Ricky in this time?
Everything that he asked for, you know, just trying to have as many resources that he needed. Just putting on, you know, hey, whatever you need here, they are all these resources for you. If there is a space, if there is whatever, you know, if I think it was just, you know, okay, Ricky, what's next? What you need to get back to yourself? How we can help? I think that's the first thing you can do with in a situation like that. There is no anything else. The contract is secondary. Whatever it is more about the person, relationship, and just trying to do the right thing for him to be back to whatever he needed to be. And, you know, you never know if it was going to be a month, a year, or 3 years, or 2 days. It doesn't matter. It was about him. And that's what we were trying to do from the beginning. It's just like, okay, we're here for you, and let us know what do we need. We have all these resources for you. Let us know if you need any of them, or if you need some extra ones, we'll be ready for you as well. So.
Right. Yeah, for sure. I'm happy to see he's still playing too, because again, going back to 08, just the image of Ricky with the very long hair, and he was like 18 years old, just a boy, and he was competing against, like, again, Team USA and running the group and going up against like Jason Kidd, who I think at that point might have already been 30.
Yeah.
Impressive player for sure. I wanted to ask in actually finally just a couple of other ones. I read a story recently that the Cavaliers kept calling you a billionaire back when you played on the Cavs.
Yes.
Because there's a Mexican billionaire also named Jose Calderon. Now, you guys are obviously not related at all. You're Spanish, he's Mexican. But it became something of a running joke. So tell us about this.
Yeah, it was a mistake by, I think it was Wikipedia or something. I guess everything started with Channing Frye. I guess he looked up my name or something, and he saw up that I was worth, you know, 2 point or whatever billions. So then he started to talk to everyone. So we weren't going for dinner, and he would be like, hey, the billionaire is not to pay. So the whole thing, you know, broke up. Everybody was joking with each other.
Yeah.
Everybody was talking that even ESPN have a note about it just to explain for everybody that they know. But some players, same thing that with the free throws, some players were like, are you really a billionaire? Why are you playing basketball? And I'm like, look, it's not me. not me. I play basketball because it's fun. So it's not like people were thinking like I was just playing just because and that I didn't need the money. It wasn't money or whatever. But it was going on for a while until, you know, I had to answer some questions to one of the older reporters and say, look, this is how it happened. If Channing Frye was the one to start it. It's true. Like if you look at it, it says that I was worth that money, but you know, I was playing, look, this is not me, same name, my family, whatever, but nothing to do with my family. Even with that, they were always like, yeah, right. Whatever.
Of course.
So it's always, it was fun. It was a great story to go with the season.
Yeah. Well, hey, listen, if you were a billionaire, you may do something like this. You may own a ham farm. And I think that this is always a story I always wanted to ask you about. Do you still own your ham farm?
It wasn't like I explained this one too.
Okay.
I have a ham business, but it wasn't like I own, you know, all the stuff. Like the thing was, I was with people like business, and we were actually bringing some of the ham, the pata negra, that's you know, a different kind of ham that it was going to Toronto. I brought olive oil as well and some other things.
Oh, you were like importing food.
Yeah, so it wasn't just like that.
Okay.
But I didn't have like the, you know, the real pigs with me or anything like that. It was just, you know, part of. It was a lot of farmers where we used to like use with them and work with them, but we were in the other side of things. Like I didn't own. But that people love that.
Yeah.
I stick with that. I remember even the Raptors putting it in one of the media books.
Yeah.
I'm like, let's go, guys. Like I'm not have a farm,
okay.
but it was fun, yeah.
So you're not a billionaire and you do not feed pigs for the purposes of curing ham later on.
exactly.
Okay.
So the worst, fake news.
That's fake news. Well, okay, I think this one's real. You were in attendance for Kawhi's shot in Game 7. Can you tell us, first off, were you in attendance, and also what brought you to Toronto for it, and where were you sitting when Kawhi hit that shot?
I was a front row.
Oh.
Actually on that basket, and this is what happened. It was probably a timeout right before that play. So me and my son, because we needed to get back to I think we were in Detroit at that time. So we have a car waiting outside. So we were like, okay, let's go to the tunnel. So on that time, I was actually on the tunnel where the players go, trying to get to my car. You know, like watching from there.
What, you didn't see it?
People. No, we see it, but it was like the craziest. As soon as it was like bounce, I was like, whoa! And I was to my son, Manuel, run. So we went down to the parking, like stuff, and we were just following the party and everything with the little screens that they were in the at the arena.
Yeah.
So it was amazing. So it was so much fun. Yeah.
That is so much fun. All right, last question. Kobe obviously got his statue unveiled outside of, what used to be Staples, what is now Crypto Arena. And on that, the statue of Kobe after 81, he put the one finger up, and that's the figurine that they've used. And there's the box score that's been inscribed onto the statue underneath. And it has, obviously, the players who played in that game. It was against Toronto, of course, and you were one of the players. They actually misspelled your name on that box score. They spelled it Jose Calderson. With an S as well. First off, they got it corrected, but yeah, do you just remember being in that game, first and foremost?
Yes, I always took it the right way, in a sense, like I was witness to history.
Mm-hmm.
So always from the beginning, yes, I was on the other side of things. That you know, it's always better if you're on the other side. But I love it. I always joke around. Look, I got him a few times. He was one out of three, so 33% of my. With my defense.
Oh.
So I was trying to, you know, so it was always great. I always took it like a really nice, fun way of like this. That was amazing. I knew that was going to be a history for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So it was great. And I always remember with Kobe too, when we played each other, you know, years later, because that was my rookie season.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it was always like, oh, okay, look, this is what happened. And, you know, I'm always joking around. So it was great. And with the other part that you say about the statue and everything, I was there like a month ago or a month and a half ago. So I went to take some pictures and I was there just walking around. But I didn't want to be the one bringing it up or making it viral. But I saw it. I got the picture. I'm like, wow, these guys. What happened is I didn't realize the couple mistakes that that they were there. So I felt a little bit better that it wasn't just me, that at least there is another two little things there. So, but it's okay. I mean, something that it was another great story to tell. It was hard, and for sure, I guess in something as important as it is, for sure they will try to fix it. It's something that will be there for forever to remember someone like Kobe. So everything got to be perfect, like he was in that sense and that game. And but I mean, that, even like that, like even if they keep it as Calderson, because you know I got an American passport now, so that's all right too. So.
Even with that,
I would take it any day. So it was always good.
Yeah. Well, I remember because I've been a long time Raptor fan. You guys were up. The Raptors were up. You know, for a large part. That's why Kobe had to score so often, because they were not playing well, and he was the only guy who could score. But my question always is, why did you guys not try double teaming, triple teaming? You know what I mean? At a certain point, like. Did you guys try those
everything.
Things? You tried everything?
We tried everything when they start getting back to the game, and he was keep scoring and scoring. At the beginning, we were okay with it in a sense of like you winning.
Yeah.
Kobe is the only one scoring. Everybody else is like not having their night. So let's keep doing this way. The problem was he's scoring too much. The game gets tight.
Yeah.
They go in front, which you just try to do everything, and it was impossible. He was pulling up from just as soon as he was passing half court, even. So it was crazy. It was impossible to stop at that point.
Okay.
When we wanted to do anything else, it was just, it doesn't matter. Like, double team, whatever. There is some images always I remember of some of us playing defense on him.
Yeah.
It was a perfect defense. He scored over you or, you know, fouls, everything. It was impossible. So
the game plan was to let Kobe score. And at least to start the game plan was let him score, but we take away everything else. And then you guys were up. It's just he kept scoring and then you couldn't get him to stop. Okay.
Yes, okay. I mean, not like the game plan was like that, but I mean, he was scoring and we were up.
Okay.
So you're like, what are you going to change? You're up, you're controlling the game. The game is under control. Just keep going until it wasn't under control. So that's it.
Yeah.
That happens.
It happens with all-time players, all-time greats. Well, Jose, thank you so much for doing this. And I understand you're coming to Toronto next week, right?
Yes, I'll be there for the West Park Foundation tournament. Yeah.
There you go. Awesome. Well, I hope you always enjoy your time back in Toronto, and thank you for your time.
Perfect. No problem. Anytime. Thank you, guys.
Okay. All right. Jose Calderon, longtime Raptors point guard. Honestly, before Kyle came around, the best one that we had for a very long time. And didn't even ask him about the assist to turnover ratio, too. He was always super hyper efficient. That's why the advanced stats loved him a lot. 50-40-90 club, I think, 1 year as well. Obviously, Kyle came afterwards, and Kyle was Kyle, and it's undeniable. But Jose is still clearly a lot of people's favorite. So big thanks to Jose for taking the time. We're going to take our last break today. I've been your host, Willow. You've been listening to The Raptor Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network, brought to you by Campbell's new Chunky Spicy Soup. When we come back, let's bring in Michael Grange.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Raptor Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, William Liu. To be joined by producer co-host Amit Mon. Big thanks to Jose Calderon for taking the time.
Amazing.
Taking the time to talk about Kobe scoring 81 on him or losing to the U.S. in the gold medal matches twice. And Jose, you know, having to fight off all these point guards that the Raptors kept bringing in. You know, it wasn't like, I think back and I'm like, damn, I could have maybe angled the questions a little more positively. But at the same time, he's such a nice man, and it was actually great to hear him just go through all those experiences. And yeah, Grinch, like, we're joined by Michael Grinch, of course, of Sportsnet. It was year after year where they kept bringing in opposition for Jose. There was always, like, this guy's going to take Jose's job, and at the end of it, Jose always started.
Yeah, and I always go back with Jose to, you know, his first year as a Raptor, and he'd been signed by Rob Babcock as a free agent, and kind of, it wasn't that common to be signing European free agents at the time. Mm. And Sam Mitchell didn't trust him. That was the one coach, really, who didn't have all that much time for Jose initially. And the amazing, I think one of the most amazing stats in NBA history, at least that I've had my hands on, is I think, if I'm correct, Jose Calderon shot 16% from three, maybe 17% as a rookie.
Wow.
And went on to have multiple, at least one, and then multiple almost 50-40-90 seasons.
Yeah.
He turned himself into a really good 3-point shooter.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also one of the people I always talk about when people talk about NBA athleticism.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's obvious who the great athletes are, right?
But
But then, you know, how good even the so-called average athlete might be. And I remember being at a practice at the old, you know, the old practice court up in Air Canada Center, or Rogers Center, or whatever we call it.
Scotiabank,
Thank you.
That place.
And just, you know, Jose just kind of fooling around and just kind of pops up and cocks it back. And just fully just.
Jose called him?
No, like, I mean, like I'm telling you, man. I've seen J.J. Redick do that too.
There are
no average athletes in the NBA.
There are no average athletes in the NBA. Have you seen, wait, hold on. Have you seen Fred dunk?
No one has.
I just wanted to put that out there. I've seen Marquise Noel dunk.
Yep.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
And then obviously Kyle back in the day, really. Kyle has multiple dunks. Go look up Kyle's old catalog. He's got multiple blocks, man.
He's got like four. Career.
That's multiple. Four is multiple.
I think his last one was like, it's like 16 years ago.
Yeah.
No, that was 2015 All-Star game in Brooklyn.
That wasn't a duck.
It was a putback, wasn't it?
Yeah. They can't all dunk like Grange. The little report that we were going to play for you was we had JD Bunkus on Tuesday. And for one reason or another, we got to talking about scouting reports of the people here in the building, because he's been working here for a long time. So he's like, Brad Fay can shoot from anywhere. Can't leave Brad Fay open anywhere. And then he started talking about you, and he described it as you got the sharpest elbows in the game, and they will be used against you. Was the number one line in the scouting report was watch out for the elbows. You know, Grange got that dog in him. So I guess I got to offer you the chance to at least clarify your own scouting report here.
I can shoot it.
Mm.
And
3-point Grange.
We've seen it.
And we
have seen it. Yeah, that's right.
I can definitely shoot it.
Yeah.
Or used to be able to shoot it. And occasionally, I've been in confrontations.
There you go.
I'm not proud of them. Some of them I'm okay with, but others, no.
It's like we're having Gary Chen Sr. in the studio again.
I'm not at that level.
You're not looking for Danielle Marshall?
No. It's not 3-and-D.
That was maybe the most insane 5 minutes of radio I've ever attended. Anyone who hasn't heard that, go to the internet, find it. I cannot believe it didn't go like crazy viral. That I was in my car and I was like, what am I listening to? Is this legal?
Yeah.
And anyway, I guess if you look like Gary Trent Sr., you don't worry about details like that.
This is the thing. I think, you know, I didn't get this feedback, but in the back of my mind, I'm like, oh no, my boss is going to tell me, like, you know, why don't you rein him in? And I'm like, you want to rein him in? What do I look like, man? Like, I'm not a small man, but I'm not going up against this.
There's a lot of reining in going on.
There's not a lot of reining in going on. You're right. It's like when you're live and Gary's on, it's just like, it's 5 minutes. There's going to be 5 minutes where it's like, it's going to overwhelm you a little bit.
The man wears a tank top for a reason. He's got nothing to hide.
Or mink. Yeah. Yeah. There's nothing in between, actually. I don't think I've seen either one in between. At Grinch, I actually wanted to pivot off of that, actually talk about the most recent piece that you wrote about. And I know for anybody who's covered basketball in Toronto in particular for some time, you would definitely get to know the Barrett family. Rowan, obviously, RJ now with the team. But you wrote about the passing of RJ's brother, Nathan. And I thought it was a really, really emotive piece. I think that you really wrote from the perspective of being a parent, how difficult this much time must be for a family, and this sort of, I guess, this nagging fear in the back of your mind that something terrible like this could happen in any given moment, that life is very fleeting. But you also wrote about sort of, you know, just who Nathan was. And I think that not a lot of people are going to be able to get this chance to honor and tribute in this way without having to know them. So I'm really happy that you wrote this piece so people can get to know the family a little bit better, and also that we have you here to discuss it. So tell us about the piece and, just who Nathan was.
Well, thank you. I felt very torn about writing it. Very, 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 very sad to even contemplate having writing it. And, I've known Rowan for quite a long time. And the one thing that we always would talk about it if we were together for any length of time or talking for any length of time was always kids. He was always interested in my kids. My kids are pretty much the same age as Nathan and RJ. And so we had compared a lot of notes, and his and Rowan and Keisha, obviously, their passion for their boys was palpable. It was obvious. And, you know, they were as excited and eager about where Nathan was in his stage of life as, you know, RJ's is right in front of you, right? You know, and you don't have to know. And what really struck me was, you know, we've been, you know, you go post game and after guys are finished in the dressing room and done their media, whatever it might be, they usually, RJ would almost always go back to the floor where there would often be a large gathering of family, friends, people from their church. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it, like people talk about coming and playing at home. Is it a burden? Is it a, there's complications, I guess. But for RJ and I think it, and the family, it was an unfettered pleasure and joy. Mm-hmm. And they were able to share it. And, you know, Nathan was at school in Florida. And, you know, you just kind of reflect as a parent on, you know, you want your kids to do great. And there's RJ doing a very special thing and knowing that Nathan was on his path. And, you know, he was a very good athlete himself, a good basketball player. He was at Montverde as well and, you know, chose to pursue being a pilot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then as a family and as parents, you know, you have these moments where you think, hey, everything's okay. You know, and, you know, we can enjoy this moment because they're fleeting and you never quite let go of the possibility that, you know, every time your kid gets in a car, right? And I'm sure your parents would have, you know, and will to this day, I'm sure your family, every time they think of you on that scooter, they're like, oh man. And so, you know, I just wanted to kind of, I felt it was worthwhile to kind of communicate that emotion that I'm sure many, many people in the Canada basketball family, in fact, all the people in the Raptors organization, anyone around who's been around the Barretts, and clearly, I think anyone who's a fan of Canada basketball or the Toronto Raptors, and just a place to kind of reflect a little bit. So, you know, your heart and my heart goes out to all of those people.
Mm-hmm. That's really well said.
Yeah. I mean, I echo what you're saying. Like, even in the first segment, we were talking about this, and Will read the statement, and just thinking about, you know, obviously as a parent of two, you put yourself in the same shoes, and after I said the words of, like, you, as a parent, you have lost one of your children, like, I wasn't the same for that entire segment, because I was just thinking about that, and you're, it's not something that any parent wants to do.
No.
I hear what you're saying with the feeling of every time you see your kid cross the road, you see them a little bit further away than maybe you want them to be, in the park or whatever, you get kind of hesitant, and you start getting a little shell shock of what could be happening, and I feel so, so bad for them.
And the crazy thing is it never goes away.
No,
and,
it doesn't.
So anyway, so yeah. So I just, it's going to be a really tough road, I'm sure. And, but you know, this that family is an extraordinary family. They have an extraordinary support network. And you just really just want to give them all the love and best wishes you can. And, you know, it's not a thing that you're going to get over easily or quickly.
For sure. And, yeah, again, you can read this piece. It's up on sportsnet.ca. After so many triumphs, Barrett family now faces the ultimate loss. And I'm sure this is not something, this is the last thing you wanted to write about. But I think it was very important for you to share some of these stories, share the perspective. And, yeah, for RJ too, I mean, you know, he will obviously take his time to process and recover in whatever ways he feels necessary. If it helps for him to play basketball to process that, go ahead. If he doesn't help and he needs some time to reflect and focus, be with family, support them in this time, you know, I'm sure the Raptors will again offer every single possibility to RJ and his family. But yeah, very, very difficult, very, very difficult. I know the last game, Denver, that the one that he played in, I think you had the, you were there in the tunnel when you saw RJ come off the court, and he had been questionable for the game and he missed a couple games because of illness. And I think you brought along that quote of him turning to Darko and saying, I gave you everything I had tonight.
Yeah, he played amazing.
Yeah, can you just describe that scene?
Yeah, it was, you know, they were shorthanded, and it was actually Darko kind of saw him in the tunnel, and he's like, and RJ's kind of walking side to side, and Darko's like laughing at him, almost going like, you were tired, you know. And Darko's so good in those kind of moments. Like, he really connects, and RJ was just like, I gave you everything I had. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then he, and the other thing, he came in when he spoke with us, you know, it resonates now because of what subsequently happened. He says, you know, let's keep it positive, you know. And I, there was a lot to be positive about that game, and his performance at the top of the list. And it just, it's incredible. I mean, you know, Nathan, you know, he, my understanding is he fell ill going back roughly a month, maybe a little bit more. I'm not exactly sure. Came home, was had to come out of school, came home, was being cared for here. And the first game that RJ missed for personal reasons was February 14th. It had been going on a little bit previous to that. Wow. And the amount of discipline it takes, you know, it's just a good reminder, right? Like, you know, personal reasons, and there's a reason to keep them personal.
Yeah.
The amount of discipline and fortitude it takes to be a public figure during going through some of these things is not everyone can handle it.
For sure.
Mars talked about that too on his podcast recently of cases where he's dealt with assorted things in his personal life, but he had to go out there and he had to perform. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, comparable to our jobs. We have things that we go through, but we're not public figures in the same way. And he's not, we're not going to be ridiculed the same way that he probably would be had he not performed on a given day. So to him, to DeMar, to RJ, professionalism, discipline, and there's a lot of the stuff, like, these roots come from your parents.
Yeah.
They've done a terrific job with with their boys.
Yeah.
It's remarkable.
I think especially too, it's like, I even felt a little silly. It was like, what is the point of like evaluating people's performances, especially RJ's performance, even when we were just reviewing in the first segment? It was like, it does feel, this whole practice feels a little bit silly in these kind of moments. Not to say that, like, you know, that's not what people watch basketball for, or, you know, like, of course, there's this sort of like, you're watching for entertainment, you're watching to follow and be a fan. Of course, that's all part of it. But there's also these moments where you show up to watch basketball, but you actually see people and they're in whatever state that they're coming into the door with. And I think that, yeah, in those moments, you, if you ever feel the need or the urge to like, what about the basketball? Like, just squash that and just be with the person that shows up in that moment. So whenever RJ's available to come back to play, I'm sure there'll be a huge show of support by the fans, by the organization as well. But
certainly.
Yeah. Is there any, what are you expecting to see tonight, Grange? Who's going to be in the lineup tonight? Because I think that that's also been a revolving question.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I kind of been focused, kind of immersed in this the last sort of 24 hours. But I think, you know, it's interesting with Orlando, and this is going to be a pivot. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make a ton of sense. But you know, I kind of go back to, I was in Orlando last year when they played that baseball series in November.
Yeah.
You look at where those two franchises were at that moment, and it's just the difference.
Seriously?
It was almost like a sliding doors event where, you know, the Raptors went down. You know, they were around 500, but, you know, they were intact. They still had all the, were the Raptors kind of moxie. And, you know, obviously the personnel in Orlando, I think, was 6-20 at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, and they go in there and the Raptors just got smacked. And I can kind of pat myself on the back a little bit because the press seats in Orlando are really good. Like, you're quite close to the court.
Right.
And it's one of those things where you're watching, you go, no, these guys are really good.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if they're better right the minute, but I'm like looking at who they were and what, and I was, Scotty was struggling at that time and Wagner was really starting to take off and Markel Fultz was,
well, I hear you though. A great year. I remember that game.
And he had just come back from injury and all of a sudden, they look strong, big, tough, fast.
They're deep too.
Deep.
Very
and
deep.
And they're like, this team is not a 6-20 team.
Yeah.
And, you know, and kudos to them, you know, and they're actually, you know, they're a team to watch in this offseason, you know, like, I'm not saying this because I've got any particular knowledge, but if you were the Orlando Magic, wouldn't Emmanuel Quickly be a pretty interesting?
A point guard that can really shoot. That's always been the thing.
Right. Mm-hmm. He's a restricted free agent. And, I mean, I think there's a couple of teams out there like that. San Antonio, also, you could make that case.
Luckily, he's restricted. And
yeah. No, but you know, but I don't think the notion that the Raptors are going to get Emmanuel Quickly at any kind of discount, think, is, you know, your wishful thinking.
Yeah.
Because I think if they're not aggressive, I think there's some teams out there that, I mean, I couldn't think of a better fit than the Orlando Magic.
They got a lot of guards already, too.
Yeah.
But one
who can play on the ball, off the ball, and shoot it when he can.
They just extended the coach, too. Jamal Mosley got a new deal.
Yeah. Well-deserved, honestly. He's got a young team to really play defense, which is what I think, like, you know, remains to be seen with Dark Horse. Like, he's got a really young team to play really good offense. Next season beyond, he needs to bring that defensive element as well. But we can talk about that at a different time. Yeah. But, Grange, we appreciate you. We will – well, I was going to say I'll see you down in the arena, but that's also TBD. So
I'm not going to be there tonight, Grange. Sorry.
Why are we admitting this on air? Raptors PR. We did not say that. Just kidding. But yeah, appreciate you, Grange. Everyone, yeah. Go read his piece. And yeah, I really thank you for taking the time to even process through this with us. For sure. Thanks, always, Grange. Always. That does it for us today. I've been your host, Willow. You've been listening to The Raptor Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network, brought to you by Campbell's new Chunky Spice Soup. It's time to get fired up. Make sure you find The Raptor Show wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe. Please re-interview the program. Big thanks to producer Amit Vaughn, our producer Derek Brandale, Jennifer Olnick, David Sis, Jared Manitad for helping behind the scenes. Big thanks to our guests today, Jose Calderon and Michael Grange. And we'll be back to talk to you next week.